I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear the fourth part of the audio version of the movie 9/11 Explosive Evidence, Experts Speak Out. This provocative documentary is based on the scientific evidence of the collapses of the World Trade Center buildings 1, 2, and 7, and includes 10 years of research by scientists from around the world who claim that the official story of 9/11 is scientifically impossible. So here they are speaking out.
FEMA documents a 1,200-foot diameter debris field around each tower. Videos show multi-ton steel sections of hundreds of individual steel pieces ejecting out of the towers at 60 miles an hour for a distance of 600 feet. They also show clouds of debris pulverized in mid-air and isolated explosive ejections as many as 60 stories below the so-called crush zone. Videos also show the near total destruction of both towers. What does all this tell us about the forces and energies involved in the destruction?
The spread of debris in a large radius around each tower, what we see is an outward explosion of material beyond the perimeters of each footprint. And this is not expected, and it's not congruent with the reports of our government.
Debris that was shooting out for hundreds of feet in all directions, 70 miles an hour, leaving the 80th floor of the North Tower and making a fairly level trajectory, that to me is fairly alarming.
Large multi-ton beams were hurled hundreds of yards laterally. Gravity works vertically, not laterally.
The number I got was 78 miles an hour. So something's happening to throw these things horizontally at those kinds of speeds. And here it is trailing white smoke the whole time. It really is indicative of some kind of explosion.
The individual explosions that I noticed 20 and 30 and 40 stories below the collapsing structure, those are what we demolitions guys call squibs. And that's another characteristic that seems to be evident.
Well, in the case of the South Tower, you can see these jets of black smoke being ejected from many locations on many different floors above the level of the impact. There's a whole bunch of these squibs or puffs that are coming out the side of the building. And naysayers tend to say, well, that's just air being blown out the windows because you have like an accordion effect. It's being compressed. Well, it's going on at a lot of different levels at the same time is one thing. And if you're compressing it out here, if you're blowing out the windows down here, how are you getting the air pressure? I mean, it doesn't really work to say it's just air pressure. Estimated these are coming out faster than 100 miles an hour.
The impact of the floors pancaking upon themselves would create gushes of air out the side, but not the kind of explosive force that we saw that would throw I-beams across the street into the windows of other buildings.
The ejection of the materials out of the building, the manner in which it fell, the speed at which it fell, it exhibited all the signs of demolitions and the completeness of the destruction down to their individual elements.
When the South Tower was destroyed, at first it looked like it was going to land in the street or take a building out next to it, and then all of a sudden it disappears in this huge cloud of smoke, which didn't seem to make sense at the time.
How can those steel columns, the massive steel columns that they are, supporting that weight of that building, virtually disappear? Why aren't they poking up straight out of that rubble at the bottom of the building?
As an architect, I would expect to see larger portions of the building floors, the decking, the steel decking, the concrete topping, much larger remnants of what the structural components of this building was. There were just small fragments of strewn steel components, there should have been much larger pieces for examination on the ground. After all, there was 110 floors in each building, and each floor plate was over an acre in size.
But the fact that it was all reduced to rubble and powder just did not make sense at all.
We have no explanation of how the concrete was pulverized. It takes an enormous amount of energy, way beyond what we have in aviation fuel.
There were two substations on the 108th floor, the 75th floor, and the 41st floor, and the 7th floor. At those eight locations, there were four transformers in each substation that weighed over 30,000 pounds. In the substations on the mechanical floors in each tower, the transformers would not explode on their own. They were air-cooled, dry-type transformers. And yet, after the collapse, there was, from what was reported, there was no evidence of them being found at the bottom of the towers. I wonder why. It was a shame that after the collapse that a forensic engineering unit didn't go into the debris and try to find at that time why the towers had collapsed. I'm sure there was other evidence that could have given a better indication at the time that there was something else wrong.
In its report on World Trade Center 7, which came out in May of 2002, FEMA documents in Appendix C steel that has been melted and even partially evaporated, resembling Swiss cheese. What are we to make of this?
My name is Jeff Fair. I have a PhD in material science and engineering from the University of Minnesota. I have a BA in physics from Brigham Young University. I've worked with solid-state reactions. I've worked characterizing materials, semiconductor materials, thin films. I currently do a lot of work with nanoparticles as well as solid-state reactions. So Jonathan Barnett's study, which I thought was very well done and quite extensive, is all documented by FEMA in Appendix C in their BPAT report that was May of 2002. Unfortunately, it was never used in the NIST report.
My name is Jason Cheshire, and I'm a licensed professional engineer in the province of Ontario in Canada. And I have been working in the field of hydrometallurgy for the past 10 years for a major company here in Canada. And I'd like to know why NIST excluded the document from FEMA in Appendix C that documented the evidence of melting steel. Why is this not included? Why is this forensic evidence not being included in the report?
First of all, let's go back to your basic premise that there was a pool of molten steel. I know of absolutely nobody, and no eyewitness who said so, nobody who's produced it.
You'd get down below and you'd see molten steel.
Like a little
molten line. Steel running down the channel rails. Like you're in a foundry.
Mm-hmm. Like lava.
Like lava.
From a volcano.
It actually melted beams where it was molten steel that was being dug out.
Underground, it was still so hot that molten metal dripped down the sides of a wall.
And the cleanup was very difficult in the beginning. Steel was coming out red in certain areas from the first couple of weeks.
This fused element of steel, molten steel.
And they pulled off a big block of concrete, and there was a little river of steel flowing.
My name is Mark Basile. I'm a chemical engineer. I have a Bachelor of Science in Chemical Engineering from Worcester Polytechnic Institute. I've worked for about 25 years in industry, and the majority of what I do is analytical work and figuring out what materials are composed of, why they are what they are, why they do what they do. There were sections of them that clearly showed melting. They had sections that were thinned away, and there were actually holes through them, and some of the ends were just melted away or even possibly evaporated away.
I'm Kathy McGrade. I have a bachelor's in metallurgical engineering from New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology, which I got in 1979. I then spent the next 30 years with three startup companies. In an office fire, you cannot generate enough heat to melt steel. And yet we have evidence of molten iron in the microspheres in the rubble pile and the metal pouring out of the side of the tower.
We could have filled up the Twin Towers with jet fuel and burned it all up, and that does not cause a fire hot enough to melt structural steel.
My name is Gary Warner. I'm a mechanical engineer. I hold a professional certification from the Association of British Columbia. I worked as in the project engineering department of the casting plant of Alcan, the aluminum company of Canada, one of the largest aluminum smelters on the planet at the time. And in that smelter, we turned aluminum oxide into aluminum, molten aluminum. Molten aluminum is silver. It's not yellow, it's silver. It looks like mercury. The yellow molten metal that I saw pouring out of the South Tower is indicative of molten iron. I was a bit incredulous when I learned that NIST claimed that the molten metal was aluminum. I mean, it doesn't look at all like molten aluminum. It looks like iron, molten iron. That's what it looks like. And I've seen tons of it. We used to cast this in Alcan. They still cast it. I spent 2 years casting that.
I'm David Gregg. I have a master's and PhD in chemical engineering from the University of Illinois. Afterwards, I went to work for Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, where I worked there for more than 30 years. You cannot get a flame hot enough to start the metal to molten, make it molten in the first place so that this other process takes off. I don't know of any mechanism for that. The only way that's known that a carbonaceous material can cause steel or iron oxide to turn into a molten metal is in a blast furnace. Yeah, and that's very different than what we had.
An incendiary used by the military, thermite is a compound of iron oxide and aluminum, which when ignited sustains an extreme heat reaction, creating molten iron. In just 2 seconds, thermite can reach temperatures over 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit, quite enough to liquefy steel. We know that open-air fires cannot burn hot enough to melt steel, but metal had melted at the base of the towers.
The next question is, how do you get the sulfur in these pieces of steel or in the debris? And that question is unanswered. There's a version of thermite called thermate, which has sulfur in the thermate too. And what the sulfur does is it's sort of like salt on ice.
Appendix C of the FEMA report describes sulfur residues on the World Trade Center steel. The New York Times called this the deepest mystery of all. Sulfur slightly lowers the melting point of iron, and iron oxide and iron sulfide.
And it just basically makes the steel melt at a lower temperature. So instead of having to bring the steel up to 1500 centigrade, you can slice through it with material that's at 900 or 1000 degrees centigrade. And if you do a search on Google for thermite and building demolition, you can find all sorts of wonderful devices that have been fabricated and invented that use thermite for building demolitions.
Thermite is, in the old-fashioned thermite, is a mixture of pulverized aluminum and pulverized rust. And if you can get this mixture to react, which is not so easy, it produces tremendous heat, and this is what you call an incendiary. An incendiary is something which can be used to destroy something by the means of heat, while an explosive is something which acts with pressure. It knocks things apart. Now, the old-fashioned incendiary is not an explosive, but it is still used for military purposes for melting iron structures.
Practical applications of thermite involve things such as equipment decommissioning in the military. When they have a piece of artillery or a tank or something like that that they don't want to leave behind to the enemy, they throw what are called grenades, thermite grenades, down the barrel, let's say. But thermite does not explode. It simply reacts, produces large amounts of heat, and molten material.
In the case of thermite cutting charges, you would have heard far less noise, since they are worked by thermal heating, melting of the steel, rather than an explosive cutting, as in RDX charges.
I'm Kim Ireland. I have a degree in chemical engineering from Clarkson University in 1963. After graduating, I served 2 years as a reserve officer in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, where, among other things, I had training in explosives such as C4. I was involved in the industrial chemical industry for 20 years with major companies. There were reports of molten steel having been seen in the rubble pile of all three buildings, and I knew that jet fuel, which is essentially kerosene, is not capable of melting steel nor iron. Kerosene or jet fuel burns at less than 1600 degrees Fahrenheit, and molten steel needs at least 2700 degrees Fahrenheit in order to melt.
The thing that most struck me about the 9/11 incident was following the incident, how overflights had detected with infrared camera 1400 degree Fahrenheit hotspots on the surface of Ground Zero, and that being there for a week, you know, indicates that there was something very hot going on below the surface.
Another question that may haunt the new Freedom Tower. According to USGS, they found as much as 6% of the World Trade Center dust consisted of tiny, previously molten iron spheres. What does this tell us about the temperatures generated in the tower's destruction?
My name is Adam Parrott, and I have a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering from Queen's University. I've been working for an environmental consulting firm for a number of years. When the USGS collected samples of the World Trade Center dust, they found the iron microspheres. Insofar, the USGS does not have a valid explanation for the presence of these iron microspheres.
But I've independently seen thermitic activity within two separate independent samples of World Trade Center dust.
I'm Jerry Lobdell. I'm a retired physicist and chemical engineer. I have a BS in chemical engineering from Texas Tech, and I have extensive coursework in mathematics and physics from the University of Texas at Austin. I've had broad experience in analysis and applied research, 30-year professional history spanning physics, chemical engineering, statistical analysis and modeling, and operations research. So, what do the microspheres contain? Iron is the main element, and then it has smaller portions of aluminum, sulfur, a trace of manganese, a trace of potassium. Most of them are less than about a tenth of an inch in diameter. They're spherical, and they're found in all of the dust blown out of the buildings during collapse, no matter where in Manhattan that dust is picked up.
You must have had a much hotter heat source for you to get 2700 degrees Fahrenheit in order to melt the steel, melt the iron, to get these iron, these spheres, these molten spheres. Your heat source must be something like a chemical reaction, an exothermic chemical reaction that reacts, in the case of thermite, reacts at 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit.
My contention, based on finding thermite residue in the dust, is that it happened before. It didn't happen after in the fires that ensued in the rubble pile afterwards. It's all the characteristics of the microspheres, along with what I see in the attack of the beams that were actually found, tell me that thermite was involved in melting those steel beams.
Out of the ashes of the World Trade Center devastation rises the Freedom Tower, whose foundation, however, is shrouded in question. For example, in the World Trade Center dust, an international team of scientists find an advanced form of highly energetic nanothermite composites. What is it, and where does it come from?
My name is Nils Harriet. I have a master and a PhD in chemistry, and I'm associate professor at the University of Copenhagen, and I have been so for almost 40 years. I have published close to 60 peer-reviewed papers in the best journals, and currently I'm involved with research X-ray time-resolved spectroscopy on time scales of 1 millionth of 1 millionth of a second. In the dust, we found what we characterize as unreacted thermitic material in the shape of some very tiny red gray chips, which have different properties. Most importantly is they're still reacting, some of them, and in the reaction they produce molten iron, which is the prime indication of a thermitic reaction. And such a reaction can be used to destroy steel structures. What we have found is a modern version of thermite, which we call nanothermite, which is produced in a different way. It is not just two powders being mixed. The material is actually built from the atom scale up. We call it the bottom-up procedure, which is what you do in nanotechnology. This has two consequences for the nanothermite, which separates, distinguishes it from the classical thermite. First, the ingredients are much smaller, which means they're reacting faster and they're more easily ignited.
The primary elements in the red material are aluminum, iron oxide, as well as silicon and carbon. The iron oxide appears in faceted grains, approximately 100 nanometers across. The aluminum appears in thin platelets, about 40 nanometers thick. It is the small size of the particles involved in this material that allow us to characterize it as nanothermite. In ordinary thermite, the particle size is much larger, and hence ordinary thermite is an incendiary. Whereas, as the particle size becomes smaller and smaller, it can become explosive. Superthermite is sometimes called. This red material contains also a significant amount of carbon, and the formulation of nanothermite as described by National Laboratory publications also implies the presence of carbon. Very typically, the organic is used with nanothermite in order to produce gas. That is a very high pressure gas that makes the nanothermite an explosive. We do have descriptions from the Livermore National Laboratory in particular of how they fabricated this material, but to fabricate it is not so easy. This is discussed in our paper in the Open Chemical Physics Journal published in April of 2009. So far, none of these papers have been refuted in the literature, the scientific literature. So that means they are unchallenged in the scientific sense. They stand as an indictment, really, of the official story of 9/11.
One of the things I'd like to stress about these chips is that they really shouldn't be there. They're not a natural formed agglomeration of aluminum from the aircraft or materials that were in the building and iron oxide that got knocked off. It isn't just a haphazard bringing together of iron oxide and aluminum, which is the basic components of thermite. This is a material that is made up of nano-sized particles that are all very uniform, very symmetrical.
The formulation of the gray chips is nano-sized. This cannot be paint. Paint does not have these exotic properties. It's impossible.
We do not know which role is played by the red-gray chips that we found in the dust. But we know, and this was already totally clear before we started investigating the dust, that both explosives and incendiaries were used in the controlled demolition of World Trade Center. This is quite obvious because of other observations, the molten iron and other findings in the dust.
This is material that is of military use that really shouldn't be there.
And our whole society is being led to believe that these fundamental laws of physics, hard science, don't apply anymore. I think that should really frighten all of us.
Just all the other evidence of seeing flashes and explosions and the melted metal and the dust particles and with the explosive chemicals found in the debris, there's just a lot of questions about what's been going on, and that these questions have not been answered or even addressed in any sort of full way.
My name is Rick Folks. I'm a structural engineer with over 40 years experience in engineering. I'm a president of my own engineering business here in Arizona since 1983. Prior to that, I was a vice president with prominent engineering firms in the Phoenix area. I have experience designing large structures, including power plant structures, shopping center structures, schools, commercial buildings, you name it. I know structural design, and I know that on September 11th, when I saw those twin towers coming down, I knew there had to be more to the story than just a fire causing those failures. That had to be a controlled demolition that we were witnessing. The government has lied to us, and we need to get to the truth. Those victims deserve the truth. They deserve justice. What we have right now is a travesty of justice.
A Freedom of Information Act request to NIST by a registered structural engineer for calculations and analysis substantiating the walk-off failures of the horizontal girders from their seats at columns 79 and 81 was denied by NIST, with the claim that releasing this data might jeopardize public safety. How could it possibly jeopardize public safety to tell people in the industry, engineers who were responsible for designing these buildings, how this failure could occur?
That implies that anybody who requests or demands these calculations is a threat to public safety.
Science is never secret when it's done right. Science is a way of finding out that is self-correcting and involves many people. Science isn't science unless it's published, unless it's openly published and made available for criticism. The thing that's most important about science is that it's a way of knowing, and it's a way of knowing that anyone can participate in. At the end of any kind of science activity, people will agree that they have collected evidence that illustrates a hypothesis, and if the evidence is contradictory to the hypothesis, one has to abandon that hypothesis and look for another one.
The explanations from FEMA and from NIST don't add up, but there is enormous circumstantial and actually physical evidence as well, that would lead us to a different conclusion, and the conclusion is controlled demolition.
It was a shame that after the collapse that a forensic engineering unit didn't go into the debris and try to find at that time why the towers had collapsed. I'm sure there was other evidence that could have given a better indication at the time that there was something else wrong.
Any honest investigator would be looking at this and looking for explosives and so forth. The NIST investigation didn't go there. They just would not look for explosives. There have been explosives found in the dust and the debris, but this has been the work of independent researchers, not NIST.
And the physical chemistry of everything that I wrote about is consistent with no other hypothesis. And all of the testimony of eyewitnesses, all of the video evidence, supports only controlled demolition as the cause of all three World Trade Center buildings' destruction.
You don't have to be a chemical engineer to question that official story. It's very, very obvious. Both Building 7 and the towers were brought down by demolition. It couldn't have been any other possible way.
That conclusion I come to based upon, first of all, my training and my education, particularly my experience in blowing up major structures that had been designed to withstand blasts. The experience that I had gained in the military and as an engineer was irrefutable. Those buildings were brought down by explosives. Well, the American Society of Civil Engineers was brought into this investigation early on, issued a report without any significant forensic examination. For the American Society of Civil Engineers to ignore those events is extremely disturbing and is a violation, in my opinion, of their professional code of ethics. The only thing that you can say about their participation in this is that it must have been an orchestrated cover-up.
You've just been listening to the fourth part of the audio version of the movie 9/11 Explosive Evidence, Experts Speak Out. Tune in next week to hear the conclusion of this powerful documentary. And to learn more, go to the Architects and Engineers website at ae911truth.org. And more locally, you can go to ct911truth.org.
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.